supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
From WHYY and First Person Arts in Philadelphia, this is Common Space. I'm your host, Jamie J. Here on Common Space, live storytelling connects us to each other and the world. And I'll take you a little deeper into the stories with conversations that might just challenge your perceptions. Today on Common Space, the class ceiling. In our Looking Class podcast, we heard from storytellers about the impact of class origin in the course of their lives. Dr. Daniel Larson, a professor of sociology from Swarthmore College, has been part of a research project in the United Kingdom, and he provided some commentary on those stories. We wanted to go a little further in exploring the issues he discussed with us briefly in that show. So we invited him to WHYY Studios to talk with Common Space executive producer Elizabeth Perez Luna.
Why did you decide to write about class?
My mom was a Marxist and very convinced that the workers were going to make the revolution at some point. So that was a little bit weird of a childhood growing up in the 80s in the U.S. in a communist household because there weren't a lot of those. But, you know, I grew up with a class analysis and sort of with Marx from the moment I could talk and thinking about the world that way. I wasn't that interested in class as a topic of study all through undergrad. But sometime around the time I decided to go to graduate school, I got much more interested. What I really was interested in is politics and why there's not as much participation from poor and working class people in the U.S. as there is from middle class and better off people. And so I went to grad school to try to figure out sort of who cares about politics, why are there class differences and who cares about politics. So when I got to the UK to do a postdoc there, I sort of fell into a whole separate project that was just on class and class mobility. And I've been working on that for the last 4 years, I guess.
So, but you were born here.
I was born here, yes.
Yeah, there weren't too many communists who said they were communists.
No, you know. No, not at all. But, you know, there was a little clump of people where I grew up in Seattle who were all interested in revolution and so on, and we hung out with them, and then they fell apart when I was 10 or 11 or so.
I come from the maybe misconception that when people talk about class here, it sounds to me a little different than the way I heard it in other places.
Yeah.
Is there a difference in the way we define middle class in the United States?
I think almost anybody you ask to define middle class in the United States is going to have a somewhat different answer. You know, some people use middle class to mean as opposed to rich people. So everybody who's not really well off is usually in that middle class. And then some people use middle class to mean as opposed to poor or working people. So it can mean either thing depending on the context. Without additional information, it doesn't really mean anything except maybe the people I think are kind of normal. You know, in the last election, people used working class to mean people without college degrees and middle class to mean people with college degrees. That's one way of separating out what you mean by class. But plenty of people without college degrees earn $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year. Plenty of people with college degrees are earning much less than that. So it's not sort of a clear-cut division.
You said you had some statistics about what median income constitutes what.
Yeah. So the median household income in the U.S. is roughly $55,000 to $60,000 a year. So that means half of households in the U.S. earn less than that. Half of households in the U.S. earn more than that. And, you know, depending on where you are in the income distribution, that can seem like either really a lot of money or really a little money. One of the key things about class is that unlike sort of other important social categories that we have, race, gender, etc., most people don't have a really good sense of which group they belong to.
Is class very tied to race?
There's separate concepts, right? And there's separate axes of division. But I think that's actually another reason we're often confused about class in the U.S. is that You know, there's a sort of stereotype that poor people are black and black people are poor. And so people sort of use race when they instead mean to talk about class, or use class when they mean to talk about race, and don't separate those things out. There's absolutely a black middle class in this country. There's absolutely poor white people. But usually in the media and in sort of popular narratives, black and poor and inner city get talked about as sort of all one thing. You know, I would argue there's not necessarily sort of objective class groups. I mean, there's definitions for lots of things. There's the poverty line. People who are below the poverty line, you could say, are poor. Whether they think about themselves as poor is another question. Working class often gets used to mean people who do manual jobs of some sort. But again, their incomes could be quite high. Plumbers make lots of money often. So I don't think the answer to talking about class is to say we're going to define working class as X and middle class as X and upper middle class as X. I think it's important to just be clear about sort of the fuzziness of the categories. The amount of mobility that's available to people varies a lot, depending in some part on race. So there was that story in the New York Times recently on research done by Raj Chetty and his colleagues that showed that white men born wealthy in the top 20% of the income distribution, I think it was about 40% of them ended up in the top of the income distribution again. Very few of them ended up at the bottom of the income distribution as adults. But African Americans born to wealthy families were about as likely to end up poor as they were to end up rich. So they had much less class reproduction, right? Much less ending up in the same relatively well-off position as their parents than white men did.
Is it because the possibilities are not there, or?
Absolutely, that's a big part of it. I think another big part of it is that when you only measure one aspect of class, you miss a lot. So high-income white people have way, 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 way higher levels of wealth, right? Amounts of savings, home values, etc., than black people with the same income. And that's because of the long legacy of racism in this country, that we've had a variety of policies in every era that facilitate the accumulation of wealth for white people but decimate the wealth of black communities.
So what's being done? I mean, how is that going to be solved?
The very simplest thing is just not keeping doing the things that have taken away or stopped the opportunities for African-American families and, to a lesser extent, other racial and ethnic minority groups as well from accumulating wealth. So, for example, we had redlining, which was the policy of only giving mortgages at good rates to houses in certain neighborhoods, which were essentially all white neighborhoods, so that African-American families weren't able to get good subsidized mortgages. And that meant that they had much less opportunity to accumulate wealth through homeownership. And this is still going on today. We have evidence of discrimination in the mortgage market, right? It's not only a historical thing. So, you know, one way that wealth inequality between blacks and whites gets reproduced is in the mortgage market. Any number of other things factor into that, from discrimination in the job market to, you know, mass incarceration, I'm sure plays a role. I mean, not just in terms of who's going to prison or jail, but also just the expense of dealing with the criminal justice system. There's any number of things that sort of interrupt the capacity of black and other brown families in this country to accumulate wealth.
You know, I've grown up here because I've been here more than 40 years. There's an assumption that white folk or people of European descent have opportunities, and it's a given. What are the assumptions about people of color that interfere with their development or where they should be?
I mean, I think we're seeing a lot of this in the news right now, right? Just this sort of all the cases of white people calling the cops on black people for napping in their dorms or for, you know, being in the Starbucks or for whatever it is. I think it's less about sort of the assumptions of families or the assumptions of communities and much more about the ways that spaces are policed and that aspirations are policed. And you could talk about the differential funding and resourcing of schools. You could talk about all of these things. So I think, you know, there was for a while this sort of dominant narrative in work on schools that black kids thought that if they worked too hard in school, it would be like they were acting white. Mm-hmm. And so the narrative, the understanding, which turned out to be wrong, was that, you know, black kids wouldn't try so hard in school because they didn't want to be uncool. or they didn't want to be accused of acting white. More recent research, there's a great book and a series of articles by a person named Prudence Carter, shows that that's really a misreading of what's going on in schools. Instead, a better understanding is that every culture values education. Right. There's the sort of myth that some cultures value education more than others. You're not going to find like a culture, a community, a group of people who says, oh, no, education is worthless. We don't like knowledge. We don't like learning. What you do get sometimes is folks saying, we can see that however hard we work, this is not that likely to work out for us. Or this institution doesn't seem to be oriented towards meeting our needs or helping us develop or et cetera.
The stories that we got, a lot of them were of immigrants or at least migrants from mm-hmm. Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it also had to do with the expectation of arriving in this country and finding the opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And people come from all levels, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the immigrant influx come in into these categories of classes and access to success?
So I think a lot of the time what happens is immigrants are pitted against either African-Americans or sometimes poor white folks. And people say, if they can succeed here, why can't you succeed here, right? There's this sort of narrative of like, they're working hard and they're getting ahead. So there must be something wrong with people who were born here who are not getting ahead. And I think that's wrong for a couple of reasons. Number one is that anybody who migrates by definition is seeking out something new and better and, you know, looking for change and putting that energy into it. Immigrant communities are not sort of comparable to native-born communities in that sense. They've done something different, right? They've moved somewhere looking for a better life.
Is the American dream as a goal, is it still valid?
I mean, I think that largely the American dream as a goal functions as a ideology or as a legitimation for income differences, right? You know, the big thing that determines everybody's quality of life is what the overall income distribution is, right? If we, you know, we're in a situation with incredible income inequality where, you know, there's a few people in this country who earn more in a day than hundreds of people put together earn in a year. That's a big part of why you get why so many people are poor is because the income distribution is deeply skewed. That, I think, is a better thing to look at than the question of can some people with hard work achieve more than their parents? Like, yes, people can, you know, some people with hard work can achieve more than their parents. Many groups have a lot of things stacked against them when they try to do that. So most people from those groups are not going to be able to, no matter how hard they work or how dedicated they are, or how smart they are, because there are so many things stacked against them, because they won't be hired for jobs that can get them into those top parts of the income distribution because of all the challenges and barriers that they face in terms of police or in terms of under-resourced schools or in terms of, you know, so many other things. You know, the interesting question isn't sort of why does one group do better than another in the sense that that question is often used to denigrate the group that's not doing as well, right? You can explain those differences, but it's counter to everybody's interests to frame that as sort of a these guys are doing well, why don't you?
One of the things that I found in a lot of European books is that people tend to say, well, economic degrees level is one thing. The other one, and I don't know if it happens here, is all sorts of indicators that show that you're not of the economic class you say you are.
Mm-hmm.
The way you speak,
mm-hmm.
the way you are educating or with the common basic things that you need to know to be an informed citizen.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you see too?
So I really like a French theorist called Pierre Bourdieu, whose name I don't pronounce exactly right because I never learned French. But he talks about three forms of capital that people can have. And those are economic capital, which is fairly straightforward. Social capital, which is sort of the connections or the name you might have. In Europe, it might be being a member of the nobility still. You know, the name of the school you went to, those sorts of things that signal sort of your group membership of various sorts. And then cultural capital. And that's in some sense the most interesting one and the one that has some overlaps with what you were just saying. So cultural capital can be just your level of education, but it can also be embodied. It can be sort of the way you hold yourself, your tastes, your dispositions, the way you see the world. And the argument that he makes that I think is right is that's profoundly shaped by the social position you grow up in. So if you grow up in a privileged environment, you're more likely to feel at ease in institutions designed for middle-class people. And you're more likely to understand sort of what the norms and what the rules are and to be able to choose the wine that everybody expects you to choose or whatever it is. And some of those examples feel a little bit silly, but, you know, if you're at a, we just hired at my institution, part of that is going out to a slightly fancy dinner. And if that's something that's unfamiliar or uncomfortable for you, it's going to be a lot harder to make small talk and sort of impress the people who are deciding whether to hire you than if it's something you've done since you were 10. And the other thing that I think is important about that is that you can have different levels of different kinds of capital, right? You can have a lot of economic capital, but not very much cultural capital. And that looks really different than somebody with a lot of cultural capital of various forms and much less economic capital. So sort of at the among people who are all relatively privileged, there can be really big differences in the forms of capital they have, we say the composition of their capital, that make for, you know, dislikes across those differences, different expectations, different standards, etc.
Do you think that that's what makes the difference in different cultures, is this weaving of sources of culture?
You know, I think looking at cultures of groups or communities to explain who does well or who has good class outcomes is generally speaking a bad way to go about it, because most of what's going on is direct oppression or discrimination, etc., or really reasonable reactions to that. So if you look in, I mean, there's this whole debate in sociology around the sort of culture of poverty argument that started or that was sort of at its peak with the Moynihan Report. And we've, you know, at least as sociologists, really become very clear that, you know, cultures of groups of people are not where the explanation for different class outcomes lies.
It's too facile.
It's facile, and it's victim blaming, essentially. You know, it's sort of saying there must be something wrong with that group that they haven't done as well as other groups, when instead, if you look at any aspect of federal or state policy for the last, you know, couple hundred years since slavery, since Reconstruction, you will see, you know, policy upon policy upon policy upon policy that explains those outcomes without needing to add anything about the sort of cultures of the groups or the lack of appreciation for education or the ethics of work or et cetera, et cetera. That kind of argument we call a culture of poverty argument, and we don't like it.
Right. Why did you use the title Glass Ceiling?
So our book is about working class origin people who, it's set in the UK, but who have achieved the American dream in some sense, who've entered elite occupations, who are doctors, who are academics, who are architects, accountants. We also include actors and journalists and other sort of important, influential professions, and what their experience is like. And what we find is that there's a class origin pay gap that is similar in size and similar in inability to be explained by sort of measures of merit and so on to the gender pay gap. Working class origin people in top jobs in the UK earn about 16% less on average than privileged origin people. And when you look at every aspect you can look at in the quantitative data we have to sort of see if you can explain that away, maybe they have less education, they do have somewhat lower levels of education on average, maybe they've worked in their jobs less long, that doesn't turn out to make much difference. You can explain about half of the pay gap, but there's about an 8% gap that isn't explained by anything that's in our quantitative data.
So it just is.
Well, it just is. And then we did qualitative work. We did interviews and case studies to sort of get at what's that other half about. And that other half is in substantial part about sort of class, what I call class cultural elements. So it's not the same as a culture of poverty argument, but what we're saying is, you know, there are all sorts of ideas about what makes somebody good in their jobs that aren't really about merit or skill or talent or hard work. They're about, do you wear the right shoes? Or can you crack the right joke at the right moment in a meeting? Or do you schmooze well with the clients? Or do people just sort of feel like you fit in?
Do you play the game?
Exactly. Do you play the game? And do you play the game the same way that the people who are already there play the game?
So it's a learned behavior.
Yeah.
Huh. So what's your take on the white privilege thing?
White privilege actually absolutely exists, right? That's really clear. I think a lot of things that get called white privilege are called that for a really good reason, right? Which is to focus on the unfair advantages that whites have. I think a lot of the unfair advantages that whites have looked at in the broader context are advantages that everybody should have. They're actually sort of rights that we should all have, right? It's, you know, everybody should be free to nap in their dorm without anybody interrupting them, right? And calling the police. Everybody, I mean, I don't know if going to Starbucks should be a right, but nobody should have the cops called on them because they're waiting for a friend in Starbucks, right? A lot of things that get called white privilege are really sort of universal rights that everybody ought to have. And, you know, we focus on white privilege to sort of call out the unfair advantages of the white folks, which I think is the right place to focus.
Yeah, I mean, it's the assumption is that if you're white, you're okay.
Right.
But if you're black, there's something wrong if you're not in the place you're supposed to stay.
Yeah.
It's a form of apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
You stay where you belong, you know.
Yeah. I think the other thing, though, that our focus on sort of race in place of class or the intersection of race and class does is it means that poor and working class white people don't have a way to think about their position aside from often with using racist terms, right? So they can sort of see, I'm not doing as well as some other people, but where they are told to focus that by right-wing activists and so on is on that must be because the black and brown people are taking something away from me. Instead of looking at what's the structure of the economy, what's the income distribution, you know, are these fair working conditions, etc., they learn to look at immigrants must be taking my job, the good jobs that I otherwise would get, or black people are defrauding welfare and stealing my tax dollars. They get these, you know, these really racist, racialized narratives about how the economy works that keeps them in some sense, many of them, not all of them, from seeing how the economic structure is not good for them either.
That's Dr. Daniel Larson, professor of sociology at Swarthmore College and author of the forthcoming book, Class Ceiling, speaking with Common Space executive producer Elizabeth Perez Luna. For more information, go to classceiling.org. I'm Jamie Jay, and this is Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. It's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Listen every Sunday at 8 p.m. and subscribe to us anytime at Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.